Paul Cullen, good afternoon.
Hi, Brendan.
Paul, people will know you very well from the Irish Times, and you've broken and investigated all kinds of stories down the years. But I suppose we all have to stop running away from ourselves at some point. And you've written, I think, your most important story. And it's about you, your adoption, finding out where you came from, who you are, and I think why you are the way you are as well. And it's some story, and you write it unflinchingly. So the book is called Outsider: Survival, Family Secrets, and the Search to Belong. But it starts actually with you falling down a mountain. Tell me about that first. You kind of thought you were a goner, didn't you?
I almost was, yeah. It was 8 years ago. Beautiful weekend with old school friends. You know, the kids had grown up, so you've that new freedom again. So you were, one of them lives in Germany, and we went to the Alps, and we climbed a hill, climbed a mountain, the Zugspitze, which is the highest mountain in Germany, but it's mostly a walk, you know. Everything fine, beautiful day. There had been a heavy dump of snow the night before, and we had to trudge through that. But by the end of the day, I was trying to get up to the top. Probably shouldn't have. I went beyond where I should have. The snow became icy. Fatigue sets in. Just under the peak, I missed a hold. I was supposed to grab for a cable, and I missed it. And I just started falling, and I kept falling. I slid down a very steep icy slope. Came to a sort of a slow down, seemed to stop, and then I flipped over onto my back and I went down 500 feet. It was a very strange, almost out-of-body experience where you're almost looking at yourself and this is happening to you rather than you're actually in this experience. Yeah. Like, you know, it's like Top Cat, it's like a cartoon cat who goes off the edge of the cliff and then looks at it and then falls. I was conscious throughout. Eventually the slope must have evened out. I slowed down. I came to a halt in this giant, beautiful valley, white snow everywhere, blue skies above, the light draining out of the day. I could feel my head was okay, my feet were okay, my arms were good, but the middle of my body wasn't right. And I just lay there wondering, you know, what's going to happen. Funny enough, I felt I was going to be rescued. I thought, this is Germany. They do rescues here. So in that time, I said, you know, all sorts of thoughts come through your mind. I started thinking about, obviously, my friends and my family, my life at home, and how I wanted to get back to that, and how, if I did get back to it, I'd make a pact with myself to do things differently and to look back into my past in a way that I hadn't done before, because there always seemed to be something missing. So I lay there. I was becoming hypothermic. The minutes went by, vast open silence. And then I heard the whir of a helicopter, and, like, you know, the cavalry coming, you know, the helicopter came. The mountain rescue people winched down and they stabilised me and they rescued me. They took me to a clinic where I was received an emergency operation. I'd broken my back and other injuries.
I presume all of that, like all the damage, is kind of irrelevant. You must be just so grateful.
Oh, absolutely. My luck was made in that moment, in the nature that I survived the fall and in the fact where it happened. And they had such efficient rescue operations and such brilliant surgeons who operated on me. So I vowed, and then I had weeks in the hospital over there where I had to ponder my life, really. And that sense of something missing that had struck me on the mountain. And I said, well, it's time now to look at things that I'd shied away from before.
Because you kind of do say there always been a kind of a want in you, in a way, a lacking, you say, you know, proper sense of yourself. Like, describe that, Paul, to me. Were you unhappy, difficult?
Yeah, I mean, there's a line in the book where I say that I had the sense of things happening in front of me rather than to me. And in a way that fits in with being a journalist, you know, you report on things, you're living in other people's lives. For 30 years, I was a journalist and never wrote about myself. There's an anecdote in the book where a colleague, late colleague comes, I mentioned that I'm adopted and she's a very good features writer. She comes down to me, she said, "Will you tell me your story?" I couldn't run fast enough away from her. I did not want to deal with that.
So you
I
were
was
observing.
Okay on the neutral territory writing about other people, but not about myself. And it wasn't just about being adopted as well. It was also that I was a late adoptee. I didn't know where I was for the first 3 years of my life.
So tell me about what the difference that makes. So you were 2.5 when you were adopted.
Yeah.
Your parents were older as well,
yeah,
which I also think that adds to the complicatedness of it, does it?
Yeah, well, I mean, they were of another generation, not given to emoting, not make physical shows of affection. I suppose I was one of those rebellious kids when we grew up in those decades, you know, when punk came and so on, where I gave my parents a hard time. You know, they seemed to be, you know, sort of very old and very old fashioned, and they seemed to stand for a lot of things that I wanted to rebel against. But of course, I was rebelling about my own situation as well.
Yeah.
About what I saw.
Your mother was very angry too, though, wasn't she? Like, she was angry at your birth mother. She was kind of angry at you as well, wasn't she?
She was. She was full of love too, and full of ambition for me, I think. See, it's complicated.
Yeah.
And it's hard to get the balance right. And I've tried to do so.
And you make it very clear you were loved. You felt
absolutely
loved.
Yeah. And I think
that's important.
That has sustained me right through everything.
Yeah.
Both the love I got at home, and also from being lucky enough to pick up great friends along the way.
But why was your mother, like, the way she talked about your birth mother and stuff, and then kind of had that anger with you as well?
Yeah, so in the book I do, I do some detective work really, and there had been stray mentions of events in her past. So there were two things really. One was that way back in her past in the 1920s. So she grew up in a large family of working class Dublin family. And then she was farmed out, as many kids were, to a well-to-do uncle. And he treated her like a princess, brought her to shows, brought her to the horse show and so on. And she had a glimpse of a better life. He unfortunately died prematurely and she was thrown back into the family where she, you know, she had to do the housework, leave school at 12, and very limited options along with many women in that period. However, she later got married, but my parents were married. This was before I came along, and as I discovered, and I've written it up in the book, one day she was walking back from Mass and it was they had been married for about 10 years, I think, and she was pregnant. A baby was finally coming. And unfortunately, a motorbike that was going along skidded, came up the pavement and knocked her down. So she lost the ability. She lost her child and she lost the ability to have children after that. And I don't think she ever recovered from that. And while adopting me as a child helped, it didn't seal the wound. It didn't heal the wound completely.
So your birth mother first tried to make contact with you when you turned 18. You weren't interested at that point. Why?
I was very sensitive to, hypersensitive to the my adoptive parents. Firstly, I was living at home and they were deeply insecure. They always felt I could be whipped away from them at any moment, at any age, which wasn't the case after the adoption order was signed. But they didn't know that. They didn't understand the legalities. So I would have been very sensitive to that. So I think that was the preeminent feeling that I had when I didn't say no. I said, "I'm not ready for this. Tell my birth mother I'm okay. She shouldn't feel guilty about having given me up or relinquished me. And I'll come back to it at a later stage."
Okay.
Which I did.
And you came back in your 30s, you were ready.
Yeah, so...
Did you have a fancy about her in the meantime? Like, did you imagine what she might be?
Oh, absolutely, yeah. You go through all that. I had a big thing about Joni Mitchell, for example, musically, and she's a woman who gave up a child in her early life. And around the time that I was being reunited with my birth mother, I think she was outed and ended up in contact with her child. So you, there was always that notion that it would be somebody, you know, famous or whatever. Yeah. And it was sustained by the bogus stories, I suppose, that my adoptive mother told me about, romanticised fairy tales about how, you know, your father, your mother was a doctor and your father was a professor and they, it just wasn't meant to be, or they died in a terrible car crash.
So the stories would change all the time.
They would change all the time. Yeah. And they came from a place of love, but they were confused.
Yeah, it's very confusing for you. Yeah. When you did meet your mother then in your 30s, like you got on well and everything, but you do say it was underwhelming.
I do. So, you know, all adoptees have a unique insight into nature versus nurture.
Yeah.
In my case, and it varies, of course, for everybody, but in my case, I think that nurture was very strong, particularly my mother's, my adoptive mother's driving instinct. So when I met my birth mother, I was very conscious of the generational difference, the city versus country difference, the attitudes towards religion, more than similarities. I wasn't used to looking at people and saying, oh, they're my kith and kin. They resemble mm-hmm. me. I always thought of people as being other, and it was hard to undo that. Now, with time, I think we've got to a place which is comfortable, you know, and I have a very good relationship with her children. She later got married, I suppose, because they're closer in outlook and generation to me.
And do they feel like, you know, as my mother would say, they know their own? Do you feel like they're your own?
Yeah, I mean, I have been so lucky that I've been made so welcome
and
by
you,
this
wider
family.
Do you hum with them, like, in a way of that they're kin? Lord,
yes,
do you,
I think
you,
so.
You can
yeah.
see
it. It took a while, but yes.
Yeah. So that's the first time you've been able to see
yes,
anyone.
Yes. And remember then, at that stage, I hadn't had my own family. So then, of course, the next stage in this, and for many adoptive people, it's a very important phase, is when you have your own children and you look at them and then you realise
that's
the blood relation.
Yeah. So you had your own family. You married to Dee and you have four kids. Were you worried because the 2.5 years, which I want to come back to, that important part of life, but because in general you hadn't had like any kind of maybe normal modelling of parent-children thing and everything, were you worried about becoming a parent yourself?
That's a good question, really. No, I came at it late, had my children late, and I was kind of eager to play catch up, I suppose.
Yeah.
I wanted to be involved. No, I think, Brendan, because I think I grew up, so I had a lot of instability in that period about which I knew nothing. But by the time I got to living in an adopted family, I had a lot of stability.
You had security.
And so I had that kind of template to work from, I think. And that would be one that I would seek to emulate with my own children, yes.
And then in your 40s, did things kind of come to a head for you? But you had a class of a breakdown, breakthrough.
Yeah. I think we like the tires on the car got worn down. And, you know, it's said about adopted people that they lack resilience sometimes because of the instability in their earlier life. And I think that's maybe what happened to me. I mean, when I look back at it, I put myself through the ringer in a lot of ways. It wasn't just falling down that mountain. I felt, you know, I was rescued from another mountain. I'd tied up in an armed robbery in Africa, you know, all sorts of things happened.
Were you
to me.
Kind of attracted to that kind
yeah,
of thing?
I don't think I rated my own life strongly enough in terms of being protective about it, possibly. I certainly used up a lot of the 9 lives that a cat might have. But I was also attracted to adventure and I got an awful lot out of that too.
Yeah.
But then the layers did wear thin and I think I became a crankier, less centered person. And it took, you know, maybe the accident of the mountain to force a proper reevaluation of where I was going.
So then you call your mother Olive in the book. What did Olive tell you about your father?
Well, we communicated a bit before we met in letters, which was very valuable in a way. Because in that she did disclose certain information about him. that he was a guard, that he had a particular name, and he was from a particular part of the country. In later years, when I grew more curious, and I have to say I didn't press her very hard in when we initially met, she clammed up. She did not want to talk about it at all. And then over time, I think she probably also forgot some of the details as well. So going on those details that I had from her, I tried to track him down with no success, really. I did various, and I am a journalist, so I probably should know what I'm doing, but I didn't have any success. And it was only during pandemic when the beginning of the pandemic, and I was writing about it, the whole world seemed to be collapsing. And I thought, you know what, I'll just do a DNA test and this will be my pandemic project. I won't be baking bread. I'll see find out. And I struck a match, actually. I was contacted by a woman who whose father is my father, who is a guard, has a different name and a different part of the country. So some of the details seem to match and some didn't.
Okay, but you're pretty sure that was him?
Well, I don't think the technology lies. Yeah. So
but you never got to meet him?
Unfortunately, we were due to meet and he died just before we were due to meet.
So it all sounds slightly unsatisfying in a way, but I get the impression that you did get what you needed.
Yeah, I don't think it was actually, Brendan. Isn't the journey sometimes the best thing rather than the arrival at the destination?
Yeah.
I think it was cathartic for me to go on the investigation that I did. Come to an evaluation of the role of these different women. So I had all these different women who were involved in different ways. I had my birth mother, a foster mother we haven't even talked about, and my adoptive mother, and even the social workers in the adoption agency were closely involved with me for many stages. And, you know, for the most part, people acted to the best of their ability, given the times that they lived in and the mores that existed then and some of the baggage that they were carrying themselves as well. And that's very sustaining for me.
So understanding that was good.
Yeah.
And like you found out when you got your full files, you found out how hard Olive had fought to keep you.
Yes, yeah. You see, so I was born in London and...
Maybe before that.
Yeah.
Tell us about, because this does feed into the broader, this story of adoption, which is this huge complicated story in Ireland. People might not have heard of PFIs.
Yeah, so pregnant
from Ireland. Underground railroad you described.
So there it was on my file, little note, PFI, and that is shorthand for all of these women. Like, we know about the flow of women who left Ireland to give babies out of sight because they weren't married. But they were treated in a generic sense in Britain, and they got this moniker PFI, in such a way that they would be funneled back into adoption agencies and sent back to Ireland, because the London Council and the British authorities were desperate not to have these Irish women and their children as a financial load on their books. So it was a two-way process, and there's been very little focus on this. So,
So you were born in a place called St. Pelagia's Home for Penitent Girls, or
Highgate in London. Yeah.
So then what? Very quickly, they're trying to offload all of a new back.
So then there was an adoption agent, a Catholic one in Britain, called Crusade of Rescue. And they were linked with the Catholic Protection and Rescue Society of Ireland in South Ann Street in Dublin.
Of all of it, yeah.
Well, the rescue is the thing. Yeah. As I say, rescue for what, you know, or from what. So there was this almost this perverse underground railroad, you know, this kind of conveyor belt system. And it was only when a British journalist last year said to me, you know, you were deported from England. I never occurred. Because I was born in Britain, I was actually a British citizen. But neither I nor my mother got much choice in that. Then they were sent back to England, sent back to Ireland.
And then Olive fought hard then to try and keep you.
So she flip flopped a bit. I mean, she tried to work. She was a nurse and she tried to work. She could not work and mind me. She could do one or the other. But she resisted signing the adoption papers for quite a long time before she capitulated and bowed to the inevitable.
Yeah, you're kind of understating it there, but you do say in the book, I think, that you were as forced an adoption.
I think that's that's part of the kind of process of analysis that I'm saying. Yeah, that would be my conclusion, and that would be true for many others too.
Yeah, which must be a kind of I don't know. That must hit you, like.
Yeah, and there's no regard to that. For example, I know there's a redress scheme, and I've no interest in it. And I don't think Olive would have any interest in it either. But there was no consideration that St. Pelagia's in London should be part of that, for example. That's something that happened in some other country, but it was intimately bound to what was happening in Ireland.
Yeah.
So it was a kind of, it was an import-export industry that we were very good at the time. In 1967, 97% of babies that were born outside marriage were adopted.
You know, come here. What do you think of adoption now as, I don't know, is the word solution the right word?
Yeah.
What do you think of adoption?
Well, throughout my life, my sympathies from my upbringing were always with my adoptive mother. I can remember I remember her listening to Gay Byrne talk, you know, reading about letters about this issue on his program many decades ago, and the sadness, I could see the sadness at her as she was at her kitchen sink, looking out the window, you know, tears in her eyes. But I do think it has a place. I do think it has a place. The problem, as it was practiced back in those decades, was that it was so secret. It was privatized effectively. And even now, we don't really know what happened. So I think it has a place. I really do.
Yeah.
But not in, like, when it was at its height, there was little enough regard paid to the interests of the child. And I don't think that would happen now. But it was more about the interests of the adults, you know, the couples who couldn't have children, the need for single women not be going around with their babies because society didn't approve it at the time. And the child got lost there. Somewhere along the way. I don't know, many people said to me, obviously growing up, I think every adoptive people, where somebody says, weren't you lucky that your mom and dad took you, you know? It's funny in a way, really. They mean well.
Yeah, okay. So that 2.5 years you mentioned, which is such an important 2.5 years. So you spoke to Dr. Tony Bates, whom our listeners know well. First, we'll go into the general of that 2.5 years and then the specifics of your experience. So that was there for you. Like, where was I in that 2.5 years? You spoke to Tony and he explained to you how important that 2.5 years is.
Absolutely. Yeah. I mean, it's just incredible the rate at which a tiny baby develops. Even last week, there was a study in the newspaper by scientists in Belfast saying at 2 months children can, you know, sort of understand signals and things that they see on a piece of paper. So millions of brain cells are being added every day. The bond between the child and the caregiver is vital. And in my case, that was all a blank. I had no idea what had happened in that time.
Like, none of us remember it, but we all know where we were, and we know that it was, you know.
I did know was that, through old neighbours, is that on the day that I arrived in my adoptive parents' house when I was 2.5, I was in a very poor state. I had a very bad nappy rash. I was wearing old sandals that had been varnished to make them last longer. And it wasn't just my adoptive mother who said that, there were neighbours and relatives who were there. So it was a worry, I suppose. And
you're understating all of it. To think of yourself at two and a half, an innocent little child coming there in that state,
And as I write in the book, it was when my own son was 2.5 and dancing around the front room at one Christmas morning, it just struck me. I just couldn't believe that he was so complete and joyous, a human, tiny human being, and that was me once. That was me once.
Yeah, you cried and cried, didn't you?
I did. I did. But I also said, I have to find out more.
Yeah.
And I was lucky in the sense that the veil was lifted, because in the last few years, adoptees have been given access to their files. And in those files, there were clues. I mentioned the PFI earlier, but there were also clues about where I was. In fact, in my file was the address in Bray where I had lived for my first few years of my life. I was able to put it into the phone and get a picture of the house up immediately. And later I visited.
So what do you know about it now?
So I was, to my relief, I was in, when I was in England for several months, I was moved around different places. But when I came to Ireland, I was in a single foster placement with a woman in Bray, and who also had other children. So I was in I had some stability, and I also had the company of other children, which I think was
means a lot to you.
Means a lot. And I was able to go out and visit the house and actually sit in the front room with the nice people who live there now, who are not related to them, and imagine myself having perhaps learned to walk or crawl around the place in this little room in Bray all those decades ago.
So, is the want gone? Is the lacking gone?
I think I'm reconciled. I'm pleased with the progress I made in on this kind of detective story, sort of this journey. I'm at peace with the fact that I'm not going to answer everything, and I'm better able to appreciate the luck I've had, the good fortune, the friends, the family, and even the achievements, even this achievement. And maybe for the first time to do that and say, yes, you know, I had a life and I had a good one and I survived it. And maybe I had two lives.
And here you are. And well done. And it's an extraordinary story. And it's an extraordinary story of Ireland as well. The book is called Outsider. It's published by Hachette Books. Paul Cullen, thank you so much.
Thank you, Brendan.